came to $5,000, and I didn't have $5,000. They told me to go across the street to the bank and try to get a loan. So I crossed the street and met a banker named Carol Fitzgerald. I had learned a few basic things about putting a business plan together at Baylor, but I didn't think that was enough to get me a loan with no collateral and no experience. Carol didn't think so either, and he quickly said no. But I wouldn't let up. I was a perpetual salesperson. I talked Carol's ear off, saying, look, I've got 5 lawns and I could start tomorrow. That means I'll be making X amount of dollars, and I'm going to quadruple that in a few months, and you guys are going to make every cent back plus the agreed on interest. I promise. Carol finally gave in and lent me the money, my first $5,000 loan. I walked out of the bank, walked back across the street to that equipment company, and spent every penny on those things that I needed to start this business off the ground. I repaid that loan in 6 months. I was so excited by the whole thing. I got hooked. Hooked on starting businesses, hooked on borrowing money, all of it. I still joke with Carol to this day that he created a monster. I love borrowing money. That was my senior year of college, and over the course of the next few years, as I've said, I sold that business off more than once. I built it up to over 100 accounts with a crew, equipment, a truck, and then I sold it to somebody else who wanted to get into the business themselves. To be honest, I never made a ton of money off of it. I treated it more like a part-time thing. I had a lot of expenses paying the crew and everything. But I basically flipped that business the way I'd later start flipping houses. There wasn't always a ton of profit, but it was enough to keep you in the game until you could hit a lick and do it all over again. I was well on my way to building it up and getting ready to sell it again right when I met Joe.
Chip had basically gone through this whole education in the real world of entrepreneurship, and he told me all of these stories as we were first dating. I was really in awe. I'd never met anyone who was such a go-getter at such a young age or who did things in such an unconventional way. It was like every time he opened a door, he encountered another door and another, and he just kept opening every door. In fact, it was his Uncle David who sold him the 11-acre property on 3rd Street that would eventually allow us to launch Magnolia Homes.
That's right. So my dad had worked his way up the ladder at American Airlines to become a vice president. He was making a good middle-class living. But right around the time I was starting my first lawn business, which would have been somewhere around 96 or 97, he got a call from a corporate headhunter. That guy said, hey, we want to recruit you to come over and be the CEO of this office supply products company here in Dallas. He went through the whole interview process, and they wound up offering him the job. He was making 5 times the money he'd been making at American Airlines. My parents didn't move into a bigger house or buy fancy cars when they came into that money. They were just never like that. Dad didn't do anything with the extra money except stick it in the bank for a rainy day. Well, he wound up paying as much in taxes that first year as he had made the year prior to that. So he quickly got passionate about finding ways to save on taxes. He got some advice from accountants, and the accountants suggested that they start diverting some of their income into investments, some properties, or maybe a business. Dad knew I was always thinking up business ideas, so he asked me if I could help him find a house to invest in, maybe around Baylor, something we'd be able to rent out. The very next day, I went and talked to 10 people and found him a house. He ended up buying this little ranch on a couple of acres just a few miles from campus for a decent price. He didn't want to manage the renting of it, so he offered me a little bit of money to manage the place for him. I moved into that house with a couple of roommates. They paid rent, which eventually took care of the mortgage, and they also helped me fix the place up a bit. We painted it, put in new carpets, all kinds of stuff, and we just had a blast in that little house. I loved the whole process of helping Dad buy that place, so I kept calling him. Hey, Dad, I found this other place. You interested? Well, hold on, he kept saying. Let's don't get too crazy. I've got this one. Obviously, let's see how this one goes, but just hang tight. A year or so went by, and my buddies all moved out. Dad and I decided to sell that house. I remember he made probably $35,000 or $40,000 on that house. I was really happy for him. But I also got to thinking that buying and selling houses was a pretty good business to be in. On top of that, my parents came down and took me to dinner that night. You know what? They said, we've thought about it, and you did a lot of work, and that really helped us make some of that profit. So here's a check for a certain percentage of that. They gave me a few $1,000s, and that got me even more pumped up about doing this whole flipping thing for a business. Now, flipping houses wasn't exactly a thing back then, so people thought I was crazy when I told them that I wanted to do this for a living. But the wheels in my head just kept turning and turning, and I was determined to find a way to make this work. I knew my Uncle David owned an 11-acre tract of land on 3rd Street with a couple of old run-down rental properties on it. So I asked him if he'd be interested in selling. He wasn't doing much with the property, and the houses weren't in great shape at that point, so he agreed. My dad and I went in together on that second deal since I had built up a little cash from the lawn mowing business. We bought that 11-acre tract for around $110,000. That was certainly a lot of money, but we knew David was giving us a really good deal. To this day, I'm still thankful to him for that opportunity. Dad and I also went in together on buying a little commercial building right on the edge of Baylor's campus. We rented one corner out to a sandwich shop, and I opened this little wash and fold laundry business on the other corner. That was basically the last time the two of us went out on a project together, because as I was a co-signer on those two loans, the bank became more comfortable with me on my own mortgage. That's when I got started on the whole Mayor of Third Street endeavor. I realized I could make as much money flipping a house as I made running the lawn care business for the entire year. So when I met Joe, she said, I had already been through this entire education, you know, half formal and half street. I was ready to keep this entrepreneurial life rolling. And it was after she closed the door to her little shop that things really started to click for us. There was something just fantastic about what she and I did together that was far bigger than what either of us were capable of on our own. And I knew I wasn't the secret ingredient. I knew how to work hard and how to find good deals, but when we worked together on Magnolia Homes, it was Joe coming in at the end and putting her finishing touches on everything that made all the difference in the world. She was what was so special about our company. Selling off the bulk of the 11 acres gave us a pretty good windfall just before she closed that shop. We invested that money into some more land and sank it into a few more of the smaller flip properties we were used to doing. We got started building a house from scratch, too. Our first real spec home, featuring all of Joe's design ideas that she'd gathered from running her shop and working with this clientele. People loved it. Then Joe mentioned to me that she'd like to live in a place like Castle Heights someday. And I figured, well, maybe we could get into one of those houses that's a little bit of a fixer-upper. We could live there, renovate it, and flip it for a much higher profit than we do in these little student house-type flips. Sounded like a bigger risk going in, but I was confident we'd be able to get a bigger return on the backside. So it really wasn't any more of a risk than we were doing on the smaller homes. I worked out the numbers in my head, and I said, well, why not?
I truly thought it would take years of savings and discipline for us to get into a house in that neighborhood. But just a few months after I closed the shop, Chip stumbled onto an opportunity to pick up a gorgeous 1920s Tudor-style house in Castle Heights. The interior was outdated, and the exterior had been neglected. The curb appeal just wasn't there. We'd been living in such small homes that to us, this place looked like a mansion. But to people used to living in nicer, bigger houses, it looked like a nightmare. So the owners had priced it right. Thankfully, we had enough cash for a down payment, and at that point, we had the credit it would take to make the house ours. With four babies, we figured it wasn't a great idea to live in a house and renovate it at the same time. So we did the renovations on the Castle Heights home quickly before we moved into it. And the impression we made was instant. The neighbors couldn't believe how good the exterior looked after just a couple of months. All we did was paint the exterior and rework the landscaping, but it drew all sorts of attention. Apparently nobody had thought to apply the same sort of fast-moving, flipping-house-style renovation ethic to homes in that neighborhood. But we did things right, and we did quality work. We just did things quickly because that's what we were used to doing.
When you're flipping homes, there's a season to it. There's times of the year when things really sell, and there's times of the year when they really don't. And so you get into this schedule of working overtime so you don't lose a shot at making money. The longer you hold something, the more the interest on the loan will eat into your profit. Joe and I used to make these little bets with each other to see how long or how fast we could work. She would say, you did the floors in 2 days on that last house. I bet you can't do it in one this time. I'd stay up sanding until 2 a.m. just to make that bet. And I'd argue that it still counted because it was the same day. At the same time we were renovating the Castle Heights house, things were kind of picking up everywhere for Magnolia Homes. We built our first house in town, and people were in line to come see our open houses. People were just so taken with Joe's design that they would come to the open houses even when they had no interest in buying the house. They would just want to talk to us. You know, we've got this kitchen down the street. It really needs some help. We don't know what to do. Is there any chance we can get you to do our remodel? We would leave an open house and walk down a few blocks to meet with people who were almost begging us to come do work for them. All this happened so quickly. We seemed to unleash some sort of lightning in a bottle when we started working deals together.
I was able to do 90% of that work from home, too. I would hire a babysitter and go out to see a property or check on a job site for a couple of hours here or there in any given week. But I could do all of the actual designing without leaving my kids by using photographs of the location and a sketch pad, and eventually incorporating some design software that I taught myself how to use on the computer. The fact that I was all of a sudden able to do that work from a 3,600-square-foot dream home in Castle Heights just seemed beyond imagination. I was in heaven. Nearly every house in that neighborhood was like a one-of-a-kind work of art. There were homes with grand pillars next to more modern mid-century homes, next to Tudor-style homes, next to bungalows built in the 20s and 30s. Just looking out from our new front porch provided me with all sorts of inspiration, and inside our home, I let my inspiration run wild. I poured everything I had learned up to that point into that house. I had taken to looking at all sorts of architecture and home magazines, and I wanted my home to be worthy of that kind of attention. So much of what made that house special, however, had nothing to do with what I could do to it. In fact, the best thing I could do for it was to let its character and history come back to life. The reality is that old houses that were built 100 years ago were built by actual craftsmen, people who were the best in the world at what they did. The little nuances in the woodwork, the framing of the doors, the built-in nooks, the windows, all had been done by smart, talented people, and I quickly found that uncovering those details and all of that character made the house more inviting and more attractive and more alive.
A lot of modern houses in the suburbs are big and beautiful, and I don't want to run anyone down. But sometimes when you look closely, it's almost like a beautiful woman with a little bit too much makeup on. Our Castle Heights home seemed to just get more and more beautiful the more Joe wiped that makeup away.
Mixing the old and the new, bringing our own sense of history into the home, that became really important to me. I think there's something about things from the past that just calls to us, that triggers a kind of longing. Sometimes you look at a piece of furniture or an old clock or a piece of artwork, whatever it might be, and you're just drawn to it. You think, why do I love that piece? Well, chances are it's because it reminds you of something, something from history, something from childhood, maybe even something you lost. This can be true whether the piece is extremely unique and one of a kind or just plain classic. Take Subway Tile, for example. Subway Tile is the most basic, affordable product in the world. It's not a high-end type of material, but you go into any bakery that ever inspired you, maybe one in France, or you look behind the counters in some cool old restaurant, and what do you see on the walls? Subway tile. You look at the old pictures of the New York subway system, or delis and coffee shops from 100 years ago that just draw your eye and make you long for a simpler time, and there it is. Putting those tiles in a home just works for me. They'll never go out of style. They'll never seem dated. And the more time I spent in that old house in Castle Heights, the more that notion sank into my heart and showed itself in my work.
It's funny how people will get caught up in trends. It's almost like the shag carpet thing of the 70s. People who put that in their homes weren't thinking, hey, let's go be dumb. They were thinking, this is great. It's gorgeous. But there are a lot of trends that just come and go, and what Joe was aiming us towards was setting a standard that's the complete opposite of trendy.
I mean, why would I want to encourage my client to use the new hot color when I know that in a year or two, she'll need to paint the walls again just to get rid of it? I wouldn't want to do that in my own home, and I wouldn't want to waste all that time and money.
I suppose we could have gone in a different direction. I mean, we're business people, right? Why wouldn't we want to convince our customer to do a new color? Then we'd be back every year or two going, oh, you're not still doing that orange we talked about last year, are you? That is so outdated. Here, we can give you the newest green for like $10,000.
Yeah, that's just not who we are. And honestly, I'm a creature of habit. I've done my makeup the same way since I was 13, and I've always had long hair. I think I've just always liked classic. The Castle Heights house sort of focused me in on it more in terms of design, but in personality, I was always that way. I find something I like, and I stick with it. Ironically, that's how Chip is, too. He's worn the same brand of boots since we married, the same brand of jeans since we married, and the same old basic white shirt. So going after classic, long-lasting looks just made sense to me. My knack for finding antiques and interesting pieces at markets and garage sales certainly didn't die when I closed the shop down. I kept it up in the interest of staging our flip homes and open houses, and I kept many of those most interesting pieces I found for us. I started to get more creative in how to display my finds, too, building upon the idea that three-dimensional objects add character when they are hung on walls, an idea that started with the fencing window treatment I used in Drake's first nursery. I started hanging baskets on the walls, and then baskets with plates in them. I hung antique gates up to add texture, along with interesting pieces of wood, branches, and other things you might not normally expect to see on a wall. I started making trips to Canton, Texas, which holds a famous open-air flea market every month called First Monday Trade Days. There I found lots of old, authentic pieces from all over. I frequented the twice-a-year trade days in Round Top, Texas, too, and as I did so, I realized my design aesthetic was evolving. I stopped looking at all the scratches and the scrapes on the old pieces of furniture as flaws. I love that they told the story of a family that had once eaten at that dining room table, or whatever the story might be. So instead of thinking about how I could refurbish these pieces, I focused on how I could highlight their imperfections. Like houses, these pieces with the best bones were the most fun to bring back to life and the most profitable when I got done. Some of my early decorating jobs featured all sorts of brand new pieces of furniture and decor, but I quickly learned that it was the old pieces, the quirky pieces, and the classic pieces that people talked about. The quirky piece of cabinetry with all sorts of little nooks in it that came from an old hardware store, with the notches on the side and little pencil markings where someone used to keep various sizes of bolts organized. I put that piece in my home, and no matter who happens to see it, they'll wind up touching it or saying something or asking questions about it. There's a life to these old things, and I started to buy more and more of them just to rotate them in the house and play around with how they fit in different settings. In fact, I was buying so much that I decided to try something new. The one thing I missed most when I started working from home was the interaction with all of my shop clientele. So I thought, why not open a shop right here at home? Instead of having a store that kept me busy 60 hours a week, I gathered inventory as I went along and decided to open up my house for a Magnolia Trunk Show 3 times a year. I filled 4 rooms of our home with all sorts of finds and displayed them with the same attention to detail I'd paid to the interior design of my shop. Then I invited all my old clients and all our new neighbors to come by. Those trunk shows were more successful than I ever could have imagined. Not only did I sell a lot of product and make some good money, but the neighbors and their friends all had a chance to see what I'd done on the interior of our Castle Heights home. Suddenly, all these folks with really nice homes started asking us to remodel their homes. In about a year's time, with 4 babies and no advertising or marketing budget whatsoever, we made the jump from renovating 800-square-foot student rental houses on 3rd Street to remodeling some of the finest homes in Waco. By this time, our own home in Castle Heights had been featured in some regional magazines. All that attention meant I started putting pressure on myself to always have my home look clean and put together. But with my older children now toddling around, I found it became harder and harder to maintain both a showroom of a home and a practical space for my family. One afternoon, about 4 years into this new routine of working from home and making a name for Magnolia Homes, I collapsed onto the couch in a state of complete exhaustion. I only had an hour at most before at least one of the kids woke up from his or her nap. I stared at their toys strewn all over the floors and under the end table, and it stressed me out that I had to pick it all up yet again. And that's when I first realized that something wasn't right. I thought about how often I found myself frustrated when the kids would play in the formal living room and the dining areas. There I was, on my couch in my beautiful house, knowing that our business was growing like crazy and I had everything in the world to be thankful for, yet feeling like a total failure. I looked around and saw a lot of perfection, and I thought, but where do my kids sit? Why don't the kids have a play space of their own anywhere in this house? Suddenly it hit me like a ton of bricks. In my nonstop effort to make the house look good and to raise our baby of a business, I had failed to create a space where my children could thrive and be kids. I had neglected to create a home that my most important babies could love too. 11. Homeless. Jojo, you awake? Of course I wasn't awake. It was midnight and Chip had awakened me from a sound sleep. What is it? Well, a neighbor called and there's a homeless guy on the front porch and they aren't sure what to do. I'll be right back. Even though I was only half awake and he had caught me completely off guard, there was no way I was leaving this to chance. So as he left the room, I called after him, "Do not bring him home with you."
I wasn't even sure what I was going to do, but off I went. And that night, on a neighbor's front porch, I was introduced to Cedric, a guy who had made a lot of bad choices in his life, but who had come to the end of his rope. I knew Joe wasn't about to have Cedric come sleep on the couch with 4 babies inside, and I could tell that our neighbor needed him to leave as well. So I came up with the only plan I could think of. At 1 o'clock in the morning, we went to the store and I bought a few blankets and towels, and I took him to a flip house that we were working on that we were about to put on the market. The next day when I went back to check on him, Cedric was still there.
We needed to get that house into final shape for an open house, so Chip had offered to put Cedric up in a hotel for a few days in exchange for his doing some work for us. Cedric said yes. He was so grateful for the shelter we had given him that he got out there and worked his tail off for us. It's as if all it took was a chance for him to discover his own work ethic. He started attending a Bible study after that and received services from the Mercy House, a halfway house of sorts that helps people with problems get back on their feet. Come to find out, Cedric had just gotten out of jail, and here he was turning his life around thanks in part to our tiny little bit of help. It was awesome to witness. As difficult as it was sometimes to put up with Chip's out-of-the-blue surprises, the size of that man's heart brought tears to my eyes. Whether it was a homeless man in the middle of the night, the troubled kids who went to school on 3rd Street, or neighborhood kids by the shop on Bosque Boulevard, Chip somehow managed to notice them and touch their lives. He became a mentor and father figure to so many people. Sometimes his kindness and generosity scared me to death, of course, especially when he would stop to pick up a hitchhiker or help someone whose car had broken down on the side of the highway. And I really did push him to do less of that after we had children. But that's just Chip. He just can't help it. He's always looking out for someone who looks like they need a break or a helping hand. He has been modeling those same ideals to our children from the time they were born, and to watch him teach them to value people, to look them in the eye, and to say thank you and hello is wonderful for me. Chip just automatically does these sort of basic things that a lot of us overlook and don't realize make a difference.
When I was in my 20s, I thought I'd grow up to be the most liberal parent in the world, but I've actually turned out to be pretty strict, maybe even old-fashioned. I'm teaching my kids to always say yes, sir, and no, sir. And I don't want them playing video games or sitting around doing nothing all day.
I'm right there with them. If these kids want to play, I want them to use their minds and their hands and to go outside. It's funny how Chip can be so liberal on one hand and so conservative on the other, though. He's really unpredictable. I saw it from the very beginning, and I learned again and again that I simply could not put this man in a box. Just as soon as I would get in the rhythm of some preconceived expectation I thought he fit into, he would turn on a dime and do something completely unpredictable. Then I would have to readjust and recalculate until I finally realized there are just no stereotypes that fit Chip Gaines. It wasn't too long after our adventure with Cedric that Chip came home with an even bigger surprise. He'd found a couple who wanted to buy our Castle Heights house, so he'd gone out and bought us a new house to move into and flip. What? I said. Chip, I love this house. You were just saying that this house isn't good for the kids, Joe. I know, but we can change that. I mean, Chip, this isn't just another house. This is a forever house. Joe, this was never meant to be our forever house. We're not ready for our forever house. This isn't everything for us. It isn't everything we want. This is a flip house. It's a big flip house. It's a nice flip house, but it's still a flip house. We knew that going into it. When Chip drove me over to see the new house, I didn't say a word in the car. I was mentally and emotionally preparing myself so I wouldn't lose it. It was a long, gray, one-story shotgun of a house that had been built in the 1980s. It had no character, it had no charm, it had no style. It was in a great little pocket neighborhood called Carriage Square, but it sat on a smaller lot than the rest of the houses there, and it backed right up to another family's chain-link fence without so much as a sliver of a backyard. It had a tiny little sloping front yard, too, that ran right into the street. Nothing stately, nothing old, nothing beautiful. I hated it.
Of course, you've got to remember that Joe pretty much hated every new flip house that we ever moved into the first she laid eyes on it. I think this one just stung a lot more because we were coming off of such a gorgeous old house. Maybe we had stayed there a little too long. It had been years by the time this all unfolded. We were getting pretty comfortable in that house. I've got to say, I don't like it when things get too comfortable. To me, it's a motivation thing. Comfort is what you do when you retire. So if there's any way you can keep pushing off that I'm completely comfortable idea, then it keeps you a little bit wily. It keeps you young. It keeps you hungry. It's kind of Rocky-esque. In those movies, Rocky Balboa had all the hunger and desire when he first started out. It wasn't until after he had all the money and the cars and the house and the wife and the kid and the dog that something kind of happened. He lost that fire. For me, I've always thought of moving as part of that motivation. Houses for me are just investments, inventory, if you will. That's it. So if you've got the money to live in the house that you're in, well, then great. But whenever things were tight, then it immediately comes back to, hey, this is just an investment. It's like a car dealer who drives a BMW for a couple of weeks, knowing that if all hell breaks loose, he'll sell the car, because again, it's just inventory. Once we settled into the Castle Heights house, I think we both started to settle into a groove. The business was rocking and rolling, and so we just started to think, you know, we've made it. We're here. Let's put everything on autopilot. But here's something I've noticed. Whenever you do that, whenever you're all settled in and think that's it, that's when the big blow comes and knocks you back to square one. That hadn't happened yet. In fact, Waco was pretty steady. We didn't experience the tsunami of economic slowdown that the rest of the country experienced after the housing market collapse in 2008. As we rolled into 2010 and even 11, the effects of that were just starting to make their way into the Waco economy. Even that didn't affect us personally, not right off the bat, but I could already see that it was taking a little longer to move a flip property. Rental income had dropped just a little bit too. It was just these little incremental things, and I wanted to make sure we hedged against that. And the best way I knew how to do that was to sell our current house, take that equity, and downsize a little bit. Then we could coast a while if our new home sales or our flip properties took a little longer to sell. There was another motivating factor to move quickly, too. On top of the fact I just thought it was time to break out of this comfort cycle and maybe kick our lives into a second gear again. In early 2011, we started up a new big development project. We've decided to go ahead and develop a tract of land not far from our shotgun house. It was land that we'd invested in with some of the money that we'd made back when Dad and I sold most of those 11 acres over on 3rd Street. The reason my dad and I never developed the 11 acres ourselves was that we lacked the basic knowledge needed to get it done. Back then, we'd been guessing at everything, figuring out where to put streets and curbs and how to get permits. At one point, we thought we could put up to 40 houses on that land, and that was important because there's tremendous economy of scale when you get a project that big going. You can buy all of your lumber and concrete and everything in bulk, which lifts your profit margins in a big way. But we couldn't make the 40 houses work. We found out that the bank was only going to lend us enough money to build 8 units. 8! And that just wasn't enough. So we kept messing around with it, and the most we could get financing for was 12 units. That still didn't make economic sense. So we sold the land on 3rd Street, keeping a little bit by the road frontage to put those 12 houses on. And the big developers we sold the land to, who actually knew what they were doing and had the financing to back it, came in and put more than 50 units of student housing on the back parcel of that property alone. We'd struggled to figure out how to get 40 units on the entire tract, including the front piece that we'd ended up keeping. They were just better at it than we were, and I learned a ton just by watching that project come together. I knew they were going to make millions of dollars on that deal, so as excited as I was about making a couple $100,000, I promised myself that one day I'd be doing deals like theirs. Now, all those years later, I was smarter than I was back then. I had a lot more pull with the banks, I had a bigger crew, I knew people who could draw up plans and help us get the permits through the city. So we got the whole process started, and I knew that it was going to take a lot of money up front to get this thing done. That just served as yet another incentive for us to move into the Carriage Square house. Living in that smaller place would cut our mortgage payment in half.
I didn't even like the looks of that house as an investment property, let alone a place to continue raising our family. Yet because of the way Chip does business, I quickly came to the conclusion that, once again, there was no fighting this decision. It was already a done deal. A great couple already had their hearts set on our Castle Heights home, and Chip had already sunk the down payment into that shotgun house at Carriage Square. By this point, I had learned to adjust my thinking quickly since I never knew what Chip would come up with next. I wanted to stay comfortable, but I finally started to realize that with change comes new opportunity. Even though I was sad to leave our home, I quickly got on board with Chip and thought of all the new memories our family could make in this new place. There was a part of me that was challenged to create beauty in a house that seemed to have no potential. Once again, we didn't want to do the renovations while we were living in a house with 4 little kids, so we set about doing the renovations just as quickly as we possibly could before we had to leave that Tudor dream house behind in the rearview mirror. The guilt I felt over not creating any space in the Castle Heights house where my kids could be themselves was still hanging over me when all of this unfolded, and I made myself a promise that I would make a special place for them in this new house. I think that was my first ever truly intentional design goal. I wanted to make this next house be much more enjoyable and accessible and comfortable for our family. And the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to be intentional about giving each one of us our own things to love about this new house, even if I didn't love the house itself. So how will I go about doing that? I wondered. I was getting more and more confident about my eye for detail, my ability to find great furniture and objects at flea markets and yard sales, and to let the character of those old finds shine through in a way that made any room more interesting. But I'd been applying most of that vision to other people's houses through our renovation and flip projects. I'd even applied it to how people would view our own home. What might look good in a magazine shoot? What might people want to buy when they came to a Magnolia home show? And what might inspire them to hire us to come tackle a renovation project in their home? As we prepared to make that transition to a smaller house with a much smaller yard and only one story of living space, I decided to focus in on us. How could I remodel this house to make it work for us? I would still adhere to the things I'd learned about classic color schemes and using lots of wood and putting three-dimensional objects on the walls, even using pieces that were traditionally for the outdoors. All of those things that appealed to other people were also what appealed to me, so I wasn't ruling anything out or purposely thinking about making it unattractive to anyone else. I just wanted to put us first, all of us. I started thinking a whole lot about another mentor of Chip's, Uncle Ricky, the attorney uncle of his college friend, the one who had helped him set up the fireworks stand business over a couple of summers. What Uncle Ricky did was create this wonderful home environment for his family. He built a beautiful house that was brand new but looked like it was 100 years old, and his stunning backyard made you feel as if you were stepping into a vacation somewhere far from Texas the moment you walked out onto their screened-in back porch. He built up that backyard over many years, adding a cute little setting here and then another cute setting over there, incorporating all sorts of antiques they purchased over the years. I always loved to go there because there was always some new, interesting treasure to see in that backyard. I don't know if Ricky or his wife have any idea how inspiring that was to me. It wasn't on public display or anything. Nobody but their close friends and family knew any of that stuff was there. It was just for them. But whatever they did it well. And if they couldn't do it all at once, they just built it up over time. They even named the place T-Berry Farm. Ricky had a hat made up with T-Berry Farm right on it, and he wore that hat pretty much every single day.
Ricky also kept a bunch of animals back there. They had chickens and goats. He was always messing around with something on that tractor. That part of it was the real inspiration for me. He just made life look so fun. All those animals and all those antiques were just a hobby for him. He made his money as an attorney, but he put that money to work in a way that made me want to get to a place like that one day.
All of that was on my mind as I took the kids over to that ugly shotgun house one day to start sketching out some decorating and remodeling ideas. I knew that I didn't have a backyard to work with and less square footage than the Castle Heights house, but I was determined to be creative and to try. The front door of that house was on one end, by the driveway and garage, and the house just shot back from there in this long, straight, narrow rectangle with a hallway that ran the length of the house, all the way back to the back door by the garage and driveway. Well, no sooner did I open the door than the kids took off down that hall. They started giggling and squealing, and then one of them slipped and kind of fell. I was worried for a second that somebody had hurt themselves and the whole day would get off on the wrong foot. But that slip and fall made them notice that the floor was slippery to slide on. So all of a sudden, the shoes came off and they were running back down this hallway in their socks and sliding straight into the kitchen. You'd have thought we just told them they were going to Disney World. They were so excited. I hadn't done a thing to that house yet, and already my kids were having a better time in it than I'd ever seen them have in my big, beautiful house in Castle Heights. I went into the house that day thinking I'd try to envision some paint colors and pick who would be in which bedroom. Instead, a light bulb went on that started to change absolutely everything for me. My kids love it in here. They can be kids. I'm going to design around that. I wasn't just thinking about making sure the kids had a space they could love. I realized I needed to create a whole house that they could love and I could love and Chip could love too. The whole place needed to be practical and functional for them so they could have fun and be themselves in their own home. And we could too. There were two living rooms in that house, and right then and there I decided to make one whole living room just for the kids. I had this idea to fill bookcases with all of their books, and that got me thinking about what would make Chip happy and what would make me happy. I'd have my kitchen, sure. That was my domain. I was becoming a better cook and really starting to enjoy it. But what would make that even better would be to have a garden so we could have fresh tomatoes and cucumbers and carrots to use. And how much fun would it be to work in the garden with the kids and teach them where their food comes from? I bolted down the hallway and slid in my socks to the back door with the kids all following right behind me. Then we all went outside and looked. I realized there was just enough land on the side of the house to fence in and turn into a garden. There was even room for a pergola and a little outdoor eating area. That night, I told Chip all about my plans, both inside and out, and he got excited about the outside fenced-in area, too. He said, "Can we get some chickens? I've always wanted chickens, like my grandfather had on his ranch." My response? Why not? That day in that house with our kids was another turning point for me as a designer and a mom. I came to a brand new conclusion. If all I'm doing is creating beautiful spaces, I'm failing. But if I'm creating beautiful spaces where families are thriving, then I'm really doing something. Doing that became my new calling. The house really started to become a space where creativity flowed, and that just set me down a new path in all of my design work. It's not just about pretty anymore. It's about practical. It's about children feeling they can be at home. From then on, everything I'd touch from a design standpoint would have that element of balance to it, where it wasn't just aesthetically pleasing, but it also fit into my or my client's stage of life. In seemingly no time at all, we had vegetables growing and a couple of chickens laying eggs. The boys loved their room with a windmill in it, and the girls loved their $50 princess-style chandelier from Lowe's that dangled from their ceiling. The kids' living room featured a couple of big chalkboards and a beat-up old farm table where they could get creative to their little hearts' contents. I put some of those big old letters up on the walls of that room, spelling out play on one wall and using everyone's first initial in an appropriate spot. Then I redid the kitchen with a clean black countertop and white Subway tiles. I filled that home with the beautiful sorts of things I loved, from an old wooden bench to bulky antique black candle sconces and some old gates on the walls and a cool-looking old antique scale that didn't serve any purpose other than that it looked old and cool. I swear, the moment we moved into that house designed around us, I saw my family come alive in ways I'd never quite felt before. The kids were happy, and that made Mama happy. Chip seemed all sorts of content to go out and feed his chickens in the morning, and I sometimes found it hard to believe that we'd had such a breakthrough as a family, and I'd had such a breakthrough as a designer and mom in what was once an ugly shotgun flip home. It turned out that Chip's reasons for moving into that home were good ones. Change was good. It was inspirational. But that's not what I'm talking about. It's the other reasons he had. The notion that maybe the economy was slowing down a bit and maybe we ought to reduce our financial footprint, that proved to be a godsend. Because just as we started enjoying our new life in that Carriage Square home, our biggest investment ever took an unexpected turn that would rip the rug right out from under our feet.
12. Getting to the bottom. I picked up the phone, and within two words, I realized this was the type of call no businessman wanted to receive. It was my banker. "Hi, Chip," he said. Even those first two words sounded a bit shaky. "Hey, man, I've got some bad news," he continued. "But I don't want you to worry, man. We'll get through this." Could there be a more chilling way to start a conversation? I couldn't imagine what we were about to get through, and I was completely unprepared to hear the news he was about to tell me.
Months before this, Chip and I had basically gone and put all of our eggs into one basket. And no, I'm not talking about the eggs we were collecting from Chip's chickens.
Over the past 4 years, we had gone from being these mom-and-pop remodelers and house flippers, maybe doing one, two properties at a time, to tackling 5, 8, 10 properties at a time. The boys had grown into a big crew, and we had become masters of our trade. The economies of scale had finally tipped in our favor. The fact that we were buying building materials in bulk meant each individual project was that much more profitable. Right from the start, I'd been rolling the profits from one flip into the next. We wouldn't even see the money before it was gone. Invested in the next one, and then the next. And every single time I did that, I made money. Anyone I borrowed from, whether it was my dad, a good friend, an investor, they made their money back, plus the interest, every time. It seemed as though I'd really had the Midas touch. I'd learned so much by that point that I decided it was time to do what the big boys did. When my dad and I sold the 11 acres to that big development firm, the guy I shook hands with wore a $50,000 Rolex. I didn't covet that watch, but I did envy his success. Now I was sure I, too, could handle this kind of big endeavor. Doing a few houses at a time, spread out all over town, meant that a lot of time and money was spent on separate crews and trucks and hauling things all over the place. The way to make money was to put a large development together with multiple homes all in one place. So that's what I set my sights on. We basically stopped buying new flip houses and instead poured all of our money into developing this piece of land that we'd been sitting on. The plan was to create a neighborhood called Magnolia Villas. 38 comfortable, affordable little first-rate homes, all designed by Joe. We'd even gone and opened up a real estate arm of our company so that all the sales and the sales commissions on this whole deal would come our way. It was a great plan, it really was. But it takes a lot of money to put a plan like this together. And that meant putting up all of our eggs into this proverbial basket and taking out a massive line of credit from the bank.
I'm not going to talk about the exact numbers here, but it was a huge line of credit that we'd budgeted every dollar for permits, roads, water and sewer lines, electric hookups, estimated building materials, and contracts with additional crews. All so we could get those houses built quickly and sell them in time to start paying back that line of credit from the profits. We had to do it quickly because basically every day that line of credit remained open, it represented a large amount of interest. I trusted Chip completely with this. His instincts had been right every time we'd jump into something new. Plus, I was excited about the homes themselves. With this newfound sense of purpose and my mission when it came to design, I drew up plans for the most adorable, functional, livable spaces I'd ever imagined. These were smaller homes, but I had plenty of firsthand experience with that. I knew how to design a small home that I could love, one that would be filled with open spaces and hideaway spaces and the kinds of texture and surfaces and the little touches that would make a person feel welcome before he or she even opened the attractive solid wood front door.
The problem is, there weren't going to be any doors or anything else. We got the plans all approved. We had the road crews come in to lay out and pave all the streets. We had the sidewalks and the gutters in place and all the proper drainage we needed in order to start building these actual houses. And that's when the banker called us with this bad news. The tidal wave of economic despair that had swept through the rest of the country had already crippled housing developers in far-off places like Miami and Las Vegas, had finally reached Waco, Texas. The federal government had come in and told the banks they had no choice but to pull back on any pending loans and lines of credit. And not just pull back a little, but pull back by half. "We don't have a choice about this," my banker told me. The line of credit we needed to get this project completed had been suddenly cut in half. And if we couldn't complete the project, we would have no way to repay this loan. And here's the thing. We had already received nearly half of this line of credit. We'd already used it to make non-refundable down payments on everything we needed to get started. We had materials on site. There was no way out. I'm sitting there going, "Joe, we're into this thing for a ton of money. I've got invoices sitting on my desk that are due to be paid, some in 30 days, some in 45 days. What are we going to do?"
Everyone we'd worked with up until that moment had been paid on time, so they had no idea we were standing on the edge of this cliff. No one had any idea that there was anything wrong. If we called them now, they'd all be hit just as hard and shockingly as we'd been hit by the bank's news.
My banker insisted he would help us get through this, and he did. We came up with a plan. We had managed to save some money that we had tied up in a CD, so we cashed that in. Our banker friend even weighed the penalty so we wouldn't lose the little bit of interest that we'd earned. Joe had some cash that she'd saved up on the side, too, just like she'd done way back when she opened the shop. The banker was able to open up some smaller lines of credit so we could pay some of the bills while we tried to pull the rest of this together. All of this took a lot of finagling and creative thinking. Those big developers in Miami and Las Vegas would have just wiped their hands of this thing and walked away, declared bankruptcy maybe, and said adios. In fact, many of them did, but Joe and I just couldn't do that. We wouldn't do that. There was no way we were going to let anybody we'd made promises to not get paid. After all of that scrambling, after everything was said and done, after we literally poured everything we had into trying to fix this thing, we were still $100,000 short of the finish line.
Chip and I prayed together, a lot. We were doing well in our new house, the kids were happy, and we did our best to hide our problems from them, even as our stomachs clenched at the breakfast table, and we felt like breaking every time the mailman brought another stack of bills that we had absolutely no money left to pay. It wasn't just a matter of paying construction bills now. We were literally tapped out. In a few weeks' time, we would have nothing left to pay the electric bill and the mortgage on our home where we lived with our children. We were still working on some remodeling projects. In fact, I was doing the best work of my life, and we brought in some money through that work. But it wasn't nearly enough. So at that point, all of our praying led us to do something that felt completely radical to us.
I reached out to two friends of mine, and I'm using that term pretty loosely. These were people I didn't know real well. I'd worked with them a little bit here and there. They were fairly comfortable financially. Not rich by any means, but they were the type of people that might have a little bit of money in the bank and might be interested in earning a better return than the 1% that the banks were loaning at the time. I took these two guys to lunch, and as sick as I was on the inside and as much of a panic as I was in, I tried to keep the conversation all business. So look, I'm in a bit of a pickle, I explained. It's not bad news, like I'm in this huge bind or something, but we do have this development called Magnolia Villas underway, and we would really be interested in you two financing the completion of it. The bank has essentially capped us at an amount that was much lower than we had initially agreed on. I explained what the status of the development was and what we had done to raise the money so far. I've got all the work on the ground, but I still need $100,000 to get us across the finish line, I explained. I asked them for $50,000 each and laid out some terms on how quickly we believed we could pay each of them back with interest. It was a fair deal, and even though I'd kept it focused on the business aspects, I basically felt like I had spilled my guts to these two guys. One of them was completely silent, didn't say a word. The other guy, I don't know, man, sounds too risky to me. He asked a lot of questions and seemed really nervous about the deal in general. I've never had anybody react that way to a deal of mine, ever. It felt like a kick in the gut. In their defense, this was just not really what they did for a living. They were not angel investors or financial gurus. They were just good guys that I thought just might want to get into this deal with us. Long story short, they both walked away without much commitment and seemed generally uninterested. They were much better friends with each other than they were with me, and I hoped that maybe the one guy that was being silent would be able to be on my side and would convince his friend to not be so skeptical. I walked away feeling a little bit like Russell Crowe's character in that boxing movie Cinderella Man. I wonder if I was going to have to be that formerly proud man who had once been on the top of my profession and now had to wander around with all my cronies asking hat in hand if I could borrow a few dollars just to buy my kids some milk.
We decided we'd better sit down and go over everything again. We went through the old invoices that were still unpaid and the new ones that had come in since we got the news, and we realized that we now had $100,000 in invoices sitting there. So even if those two men decided to make the investment, which at this point seemed very unlikely, all of that money was already spent, and we'd be back to falling behind again the very next month unless we could pre-sell some of the houses or encounter some other windfall.
A couple of very long days went by, and I finally got a call from the silent guy I had taken to lunch. He said, "Hey, man, I really want to see the development. My wife and I want to meet you guys over there and maybe walk the properties, just get a better sense of exactly what you're talking about." So we met him over there on the site, and those two walked around just as calm as they could be. "This is beautiful," they said. "Wow, this is awesome," they said. "Wow, I was hoping you'd think that. So what are you guys wanting to do? Why'd you want to come walk the site?" "I know that meeting was a bit rough the other day," he said. "I just want you to know that I've never done this kind of thing before. But when you were talking, you were really speaking my language. I admire how hard you fought to keep this project alive and make sure that everyone gets paid. And I was actually eager to help out. But I wasn't sure if it was just my heart talking, you know? So I went back and I told my wife about it and we prayed about this. And well, we've decided that we're going to give you $100,000. I reminded him that I only felt comfortable with the $50,000 investment so that we could spread the risk out. "I know, but we prayed about it, and we just feel that this is the right thing to do. You're going to do great here. We need this kind of development in Waco, and we have no doubt you're going to sell all of these houses, and it will make a big difference to a lot of people. And if you don't, well, as I said, we've prayed about this, so we don't want you to worry even if you never pay us back. We've already imagined that. So if this doesn't work out like you hoped, just don't worry about it. We're already over it. We don't want this to be a bit awkward as far as our relationship is concerned."
My knees almost gave out. It took everything in me not to break down right then and there. This wasn't like a best friend who would bend over backwards to bail you out of trouble. They were just acquaintances at the time. So for them to say something like that came as a complete shock. They had that $100,000 check with them, and they handed it to us right then and there. The two of us went home in absolute awe of what had just happened. Then we sat down and considered how best to use that money. There were a number of invoices that were due in 2 days, but for a moment we wondered if maybe we should invest the money in a quick flip house, something that might turn that money into $150,000 and give us some leeway to pay other bills. But that would mean putting some people off by 30 days or more, and that just didn't feel right to us. So what did we do? We both looked at each other and said, give it away.
We didn't mean give it away in the sense of philanthropy, but in recognizing that this money wasn't ours, it was owed to others. So we sat down and wrote out $100,000 worth of checks. We were completely broke again within a week, but everybody got paid. Every bill was up to date. With that check, we were able to buy ourselves another month or so of time to get back on our feet. It's sad looking back, because even with that miracle, we still had our doubts.
We both realized quickly thereafter that this was no fluke. It had been the story of our life together ever since we'd met. From the very beginning, I feel like we had encountered miracle after miracle that allowed us to get by and survive. Now it was happening on a much bigger scale, in $100,000 increments. But maybe we should have been paying more attention to those little miracles all along. We were now both out on a limb, and we looked up and saw God right there with us.
Somehow we were always wily enough to get ourselves out of a financial pickle by finding the money from somewhere. Or so we thought. But this was not being wily. This couldn't be anything but the grace of God. Did those earlier breaks come from the same source? Getting that $100,000 check made us open our eyes and see that whenever we'd needed a break, when a house would sell or rent would come through just in the nick of time, God was there orchestrating. We were just so overwhelmed by all of this.
Maybe getting to the bottom all those times, and especially that time, was some sort of a test. A test of will, maybe, a test of faith, a test of our resolve to stay the course and following our dreams and to do the right thing when it came down to how we treated others. I don't know. What I do know, looking back on it now, is that all of these big, life-changing things were right around the corner for us at that moment. And if we had given up, if we had walked away, if we had crumbled when we were at our lowest, we never would have made it around the corner to see all of the blessings that were about to come due. 13. Surviving or thriving. I'm not sure what it was about moving into that little shotgun of a house that brought so many revelations to the surface, but right in the middle of our financial crisis, I had yet another awakening, a true light bulb moment, just like I'd had when I decided to design our living room space for us. And this new revelation was also sparked by the laughter of my children down the hall. I'd managed to put that house together in a way that made my family happier than perhaps we'd ever been. We all had space to be ourselves and to be together, even though this house was half the size of our previous one. The only problem I seemed to keep running into in that smaller space was that there was just not enough room to keep all of our stuff contained. Even though the kids had their own living room, everything still seemed to spill out everywhere all the time. I was still working hard to make this house perfect, which to me meant not only giving it some character and bringing it to life, but also keeping it clean and uncluttered. And it seemed as if all day, every day, I spent most of my time picking up after the kids, yelling at them whenever they spilled a glass of milk, then mopping the floors one more time. It was exhausting. I was finally taking a moment for myself one afternoon, plopping down on our old sofa with a new slipcover, when I made the mistake of looking down. My beautiful, brand-new, snowy-white slipcover was covered in little black fingerprints. I mean, there were fingerprints everywhere. I looked up and noticed that the whole house was messy again. A shoe here, a sock there, a pile of toys on the coffee table. I had already spent half the day cleaning, and everything in me wanted to stand up and go yell at those kids for not washing their hands like I told them to do 1,000 times. I also started yelling at myself in my mind, what mother in her right mind would buy white slipcovers for a sofa with 4 little kids in the house? I mean, really? White? I was so mad at myself and the kids that I was just about to lose it. Then I heard the kids down the hall. They were playing in one of the bedrooms, and the whole lot of them erupted in laughter over some silly thing. Their giggles were so full of joy. The sound of their little voices pierced my heart. I looked back down at all those little tiny fingerprints on my white slipcover, and I realized something surprising. Someday, I might actually miss those little fingerprints. Right then and there, I knew I had been focused on the wrong things, and I realized I had a choice to make. I could go in there and yell, ruining their little moment, and then having to spend another hour of my life trying to clean up the mess that they'd made. Or I could choose to let it go. I could go play with my kids, and maybe get a chance to share in that laughter right alongside them. So what if my house wasn't perfect? It was perfect just the way it was. I realized that my determination to make things perfect meant I was chasing an empty obsession all day long. Nothing was ever going to be perfect the way I had envisioned in the past. Did I want to keep spending my energy on that effort, or did I want to step out of that obsession and enjoy my kids, maybe allowing myself to get messy right along with them in the process? I chose the latter, and that made all the difference. This revelation was so much more than a light bulb turning on in my head. I felt as if 100 pounds got lifted off my shoulders that afternoon. I remember sitting there on that sofa going, "Holy cow, I can breathe." It all came down to a mind shift in which I asked myself, what am I going for in life? Was it to achieve somebody else's idea of what a perfect home should look like? Or was it to live fully in the perfection of the home and family I have? My revelation wouldn't mean that I would never clean my house again. It wouldn't even keep me from throwing that slipcover in the washing machine eventually. My kids do tend to play better and act better in a clean environment, and Chip appreciates a clean home too. My family inspires me to want to keep our home clean for them, and I personally can't think straight in an environment that's too cluttered. And yet, the time I spend with my kids is worth far more than the time I spend cleaning. Right then and there, I made up my mind to stop cleaning the house during the day. If that meant I had to stay up an extra 45 minutes at night doing dishes or cleaning up the living room after the kids were in bed, then so be it. I also vowed to set up better storage systems and to teach the kids that everything had a place, but I wasn't going to obsess about any of that, not anymore. That day changed me. It really did. And I quickly found that my shift in mindset had a positive effect on our life together. Now when someone spills a glass of milk, I don't worry so much about the mess. Instead, I try to focus on my relationship with the one who spilled the milk. I still have my bad days, believe me. When I see that milk for the mess that it is and I yell, "Oh, come on," I get mad. I'm not perfect, but I recognize now that yelling is always the lesser of two options. The better option is to use that moment to teach them. Well, you know what? I did that when I was a kid too. We all make mistakes. Followed by, "How about you help me clean this up?" What I've found is that something as common as spilled milk can turn into a rich moment with my kids. And for years, my misguided perfectionism robbed both them and me of those moments. And I can't help but wonder how many other moments I robbed from my kids and from my husband while trying to attain some vision of a perfect home that I was never going to attain anyway. Before my slipcover revelation, I never allowed the kids to paint or do projects on my dining room table because it was my favorite table. Today, not only do I let them do their projects there, but I'm the one who instigates it. Okay, we're going to paint, kids. Why? Because I replace that perfect table with a one that's all scuffed up and only gets better looking with age. I also tried to set aside various spots throughout the home where my kids were expected to make a mess. In the living room, on that table I just mentioned, I even carved out a spot in the kitchen where they could cook and have fun experimenting with food. That way I could be prepared, which means I wouldn't overreact. And that in turn meant my kids could be kids and I could be a better mom. It was all connected. The funny thing to me is that whenever we had people step foot into our house after that, they seemed more wowed by it than any other house I designed or lived in, including the 1920s dream house in Castle Heights. That got me thinking about the pressure we women and moms are all under these days. It seems as if the standards are so much higher than they were a few years ago, mainly because of what we see whenever we look on the internet. It used to require some effort to feel like an inferior mom and wife. A woman would have to go to a newsstand and spend $6 on a magazine to see the current societal standard of what my family and home are supposed to look like. Now it just shows up on social media everywhere you look, and it always seems to be picture perfect. That's all anyone seems to post. Perfect pictures of perfect families enjoying perfect moments. Along with that, I think everyone's expectations of themselves have gotten so much higher. I mean, honestly, as a stay-at-home mom, every time I had a moment to open Facebook or Pinterest, I would walk away thinking, "I'm not doing enough." And then I'd start second-guessing myself. I think that's what I started to overcome with those revelations in my own home. It's funny that these revelatory moments of mine happened on couches in two different homes, and I wonder why that is, but I don't have to wonder about the results of those moments. Shortly after I sat on the couch at the Castle Heights house and really noticed for the first time that I wasn't happy, even though I'd worked so hard to make everything look perfect, I had a conversation with a friend of mine. I was exhausted all the time, and I said to this friend, "I feel like I'm just surviving at this point, and I'm not thriving." Once I was in the Carriage Square house and embracing the laughter and the messiness of my kids and not cleaning up all day long, I realized that it was up to me to flip that switch from surviving to thriving. It was just a mental shift, a readjustment in my way of thinking, like seeing my kids' fingerprint as kind of cute instead of a miserable mess. I actually made that particular mental shift after I had my Carriage Square revelation. It happened instantly, just like that. Right after I made the decision to enjoy my kids instead of obsessing over making everything perfect, I looked down at those fingerprints. I was still on the couch, and suddenly they looked completely different. Then I got to thinking about the bigger picture. If I'm going to sit around and say I'm just surviving every day, well, guess what? When a big wave comes along suddenly, I won't be surviving. I'll be drowning. I mean, that's life. Life is never predictable. Life is never manageable. If your mindset is always, I'm just